When Alexander Saint-Alban invited his guests into his home, he informed them that there would be at the table a great lady of the revolution. His guests were all very excited, knowing his connections to the radical revolutionaries, as he had once been one. But upon sitting down to eat, there was no one out of the ordinary there to dine with, nor even an empty place setting. Disappointed, they ate their dinner and eventually forgot about their host's promise. When dessert was brought out, Saint-Alban grasped a large covered jar and lifted the lid for all to see. The guests were astonished to see a head floating in alcohol, with auburn hair and eyes opened in just the slightest. The head, they must have thought, was far more beautiful than any head in a jar ought to be. The woman, Saint-Alban told them, was Charlotte Corday, the great lady of the revolution. This is Old Blood. I'm your host, Elise. Before we get started, I just want to remind you that this episode is part two of the two-episode series on terror in the French Revolution. If you haven't already, make sure you go back and listen to episode 8, The Terror, September, before listening to this episode. The Enlightenment has always been closely associated with the French Revolution. Although the Enlightenment swept through much of Europe and the Americas, some of the most famous philosophers were French and active in the years leading up to the Revolution. The most famous examples I can give you of the Enlightenment's influence upon 18th century revolutions are the United States Declaration of Independence and France's Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. Both documents include arguments first made by philosophers like John Locke, Voltaire, Montesquieu, and, perhaps most importantly, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. If I could sum the Enlightenment up in one sentence, it would be this: question everything. For thousands of years, humanity had been ruled by kings and queens, emperors and empresses, many of whom argued and honestly believed that they had a God-given right to rule over their subjects. And their subjects, too, widely believed that their rulers were divinely ordained. But by the time of the Enlightenment, thinkers began to question all of the traditions and ideas that they had previously accepted, including the idea that certain people were born to rule, that they were chosen by God to do so. And if rulers weren't selected by God, then what gave them the right to rule at all? Rousseau's answer to that was the social contract. Rousseau most famously said, "Man is born free and yet is everywhere in chains." If we are all born free, why are we forced to obey the laws of our governments? What gives government the right to do that? Well, we do, Rousseau says. The social contract is an unwritten compact in which we all agree to give up some of our rights and relinquish the complete freedom we are born with, and in exchange, we receive the protection of the government. We give up a few rights so that the rest of our rights are protected. We give up our right to take whatever we want and do whatever we want, in exchange for government protecting us from others who would take from us and do to us whatever they want. And if the people are the ones who agreed to this contract, then it is the people who ultimately have the power. And if the people, as a majority, believe that government is no longer filling their end of the bargain, well then, it is the people's right to change the government so that it is. Jean-Paul Marat lived and breathed ideas such as these. He idolized Rousseau. Like his hero, Marat was not French by birth, but Swiss. In fact, Marat added the T to the end of his last name in order for him to appear more authentically French. Philosophes like Rousseau likely appealed to Marat especially because of his upbringing and an obsession with correcting injustices. Without giving too many details about what happened, Marat explained how he was humiliated unjustly as a child, and since then, saw himself as the writer of wrongs. Marat said, quote, "My moral sense was already developed at the age of 8. Even then, I could not bear to behold the ill-treatment practiced upon another. The sight of cruelty filled me with indignation, and an injustice always made my blood boil." End quote. Marat, the OG justice warrior. If he sounds a tad self-righteous, you're not exactly wrong, for in Marat's own words, he was, quote, "born with the love of fame," end quote. It was this combination of fame-seeking and obsession with correcting injustices that made Marat the perfect personality for the French Revolution, which was filled with grandiose egotists like him, Georges Danton, and Maximilien Robespierre. Marat actually started off as a physician in London, where he earned himself an honorary degree as a doctor. Apparently, he also took to the streets to read Rousseau's Social Contract to passers-by in between patients. I picture him standing atop an upturned trash can while doing so, but that's not exactly historically accurate. Marat was relatively successful as a physician and treated some of London's aristocracy, but he, like many French thinkers of the time, saw himself as a sort of Renaissance man and began to branch out publishing scientific pamphlets on things like light and electricity. He also published works on how the moon and sun work, as well as on color and rainbows. He then began printing political pamphlets. In 1777, Marat published The Chains of Slavery, which, yes, sounds a lot like Rousseau. Marat was infamously bad at taking care of himself, and at the time he was writing these political documents, he supposedly worked 21 hours a day in order to finish them, and kept himself awake by drinking massive amounts of coffee. In 1935, author Marjorie Bowen, writing under the pseudonym Joseph Shearing, had this to say about Marat. He would spend hours at his desk, writing with furious speed until he trembled with fatigue, then drink quantities of black coffee to revive himself, this being repeated until he sank into an uneasy sleep. Should I be concerned that this sounds like me? Coffee with creamer, though, please. Despite his earlier success as a physician, his branching out did not do too well. He sent some of his work to the famous philosophe Voltaire, whom he also idolized, but was crushed when Voltaire criticized and mocked his work. In 1785, Marat entered a paper he wrote in a competition at the Academy of Lyon in France. The paper happened to be an attack on Isaac Newton's theory of light, which the Academy did not exactly appreciate. Needless to say, he did not win any prizes. The Academy of Sciences in Paris also rejected Marat's research, though many said this was because he did not have the right connections and blamed the rejection on nepotism. And so Marat, with his fiery temper and his obsession with avenging unfair attacks on his character, grew increasingly bitter. Society had committed the most unforgivable sin of not appreciating the genius Marat had to offer. He hated this society that he also so desperately wanted a place in. Fortunately for him, France as he knew it would soon collapse and be replaced with an empty stage for him to ascend. Marat began his newspaper, called The Friend of the People, in 1789, a few months after the storming of the Bastille, one of the events which marked the beginning of revolution. The paper was a one-man operation, for the most part, and so was not a complete newspaper in the way that we are used to. It only consisted of several pages, which he aimed to put out daily. In it, he railed against the injustices of the old system and his ideas on how the revolution should be accomplished. In his own words, Marat said that the aim of his paper, quote, has been to reveal plots, to unmask traitors, and to propose useful measures, end quote. By the time of the September massacres, where we left off last week, the Friend of the People was constantly exposing conspiracies, identifying enemies of the revolution that should be either jailed or killed, and trying to light a fire under the asses of those whom Marat felt should be doing more to make the revolution a success. If there was a scandal that he could use to rouse the people to action, you can bet that Marat pounced on it in his newspaper. Historian Simon Chama said, Marat played on hysteria like a drum. Shortly after the publication of his newspaper, Marat was forced to go into hiding. It was not the first or last time Marat would be targeted by authorities trying to shut him down and stop him from provoking insurrections. In 1790, authorities conducted a raid on Marat's home and confiscated hundreds of his papers and correspondences, including over a dozen letters from Benjamin Franklin. These searches forced Marat underground. Like, literally, he lived in people's cellars and in the catacombs that existed, and still exist, beneath the streets of Paris. He jumped from place to place, feeling it unsafe to stay in the same spot for too long. Madame Tussaud, who knew Marat during this period, called him a coward, explaining how the slightest noise sent him running into hiding. She said that several times it happened during dinner, and Marat jumped up from his seat and ran to safety, but always taking his dinner plate with him. But Tussaud also called Marat, quote, perhaps the most ferocious monster that the revolution ever produced, end quote. So do with that what you will. Marat was never the best at taking care of his health to begin with, and it worsened while he was in hiding. With not much else to do underground, Marat took to writing day and night by the light of his oil lamp, which emitted poisonous fumes that had no way to air out. His eyelids became inflamed, he developed migraines, and he had near constant insomnia. And living in such damp, unventilated areas, he either developed or worsened a skin issue that began, let's just say, in his nether regions, and then spread to the rest of his body. Over the years, people have diagnosed Marat with a number of conditions ranging from psoriasis to celiac disease to syphilis, scabies, and leprosy. A recent test of Marat's blood, though not entirely conclusive, showed that he likely had a fungal infection that was superinfected with a bacteria. They aren't entirely sure what it was, but they did feel confident enough to rule out all of the other theories. Marat was an unlikely hero for the French Revolution. He was not an attractive man at all, though clearly some women were attracted to his personality. The most noticeable thing about him was his skin, which was often scaly and filled with angry scabs and weeping pustules. But even without the skin condition, people said he had a strange-looking face, that his eyes were too big and oddly placed, and his head was oversized. He was quite short, little more than 5 feet, but had a large torso. Almost everyone who described him commented on his dirty, greasy hair. Those who weren't exactly friends of his claimed he had yellow skin that matched his yellow hazel eyes, as though he were some sort of a reptile. His manners definitely did not help his image either. He was always sloppily dressed, often with a cloth drenched in vinegar draped over the top of his head to provide some relief from his skin condition. Madame Tussaud compared Marat to Robespierre, whom she described as courteous and gentlemanly, though vain. Tussaud claimed that Robespierre was so generous that upon walking with a woman who told him she admired a house, he asked her if she wanted it, saying that, no problem, he would execute the owner as an enemy and give the house to her. Marat, on the other hand, was selfish and rarely thought of others, according to Tussaud. Though Tussaud despised Marat, she could not help but admire his ability to move people. He was full of energy and gestured dramatically when he spoke. The biographer, Austin Dobson, quoted a Jacobin who said that, actually, Marat was not sick at all. What he had was an indisposition. Quote, "It is a superabundant patriotism, pressed and repressed in too small a body. The violent efforts that it makes at escape are killing him." And these, his forceful speeches and writings, are what mattered to the people. In fact, it seemed like Marat, more than the other revolutionaries, was more like the common people that they so often spoke of. His dirty appearance, raggedy clothes, and poor hygiene signaled to the Parisian working class that he was one of them, a friend of the people. They were the audience that Marat wrote to, the mobs that conducted the September massacres and the slaughter at the Tuileries on August 10th. They were his target audience. The people loved Marat, and he loved them. And how could he not love them after they gave him the one thing that he sought over all else? Fame. Napoleon Bonaparte later remarked, "Vanity made the revolution. Liberty was only a pretext." The people may have loved Marat, but not everyone else did. A great many people blame Marat for the bloodshed that made the revolution look bad. Historian Chama wrote that before the September massacres, Marat had told citizens to go to the prisons where the priests and Swiss guards were and to, quote, "run a sword through them," end quote. Not only that, but he was the one who prompted the mass arrest that placed 4,000 citizens into these prisons to begin with. Other historians defended Marat, though much to Chama's disgust, by saying that Marat didn't really mean that. It was just hyperbole. It wasn't Marat's fault that the people took his words too literally. My response to this, as I'm sure Chama's was, is a great big silent eye roll. One of these scholars is Ernest Bax, who wrote a book about Marat, mostly in his defense, back in 1901. And this is another example of why you should always check your sources, because I'm reading this book about Marat, and I'm thinking, man, this guy sure does like to apologize for Marat's behavior. I wonder why he's so defensive of him. How could he claim that Marat didn't help to instigate the September massacres right before using Marat's quote where he told the people to go slaughter the priests? So I looked up Ernest Bax and found that he was a staunch socialist, which I had already guessed. But what shocked me was that the guy was a men's rights activist. In 1897, like decades before women even had the right to vote in the US and the UK, this guy was over there complaining about how men are oppressed by women. He even wrote a book called The Legal Subjection of Men. We couldn't even vote then. How are we going to make laws to subjugate you? Talk about injustices making people angry. Anyway, a lot of people were angry at the state of the revolution and disappointed in how it had devolved into a state of bloodshed and terror. And they blamed this downturn on men like Marat, whose histrionics clearly whipped his readers into these mobs, which were foaming at the mouth, practically, eager to get their hands on all these traitors whom, Marat told them, were out to get them. Marat's colleagues, even the radical ones like Danton, disliked him. Chama quoted one deputy of the convention who said, quote, that the tribune be disinfected after every speech by the friend of the people, end quote. I'm still not sure if that was a reference to his skin condition or his character. By 1792, the National Convention was split between the radicals like Marat, Danton, and Robespierre, who called their faction the Montagnard, meaning mountain, and the more moderate Girondin. Naturally, Marat and the Girondin despised each other. Marat thought the Girondin traitors, and the Girondin blamed Marat for the massacres. Tensions increased between the two factions in 1793 when they argued over what they should do with the king, who was ultimately beheaded on the 21st of January. Marat said of the beheading, "I finally believe in the Republic." In April of that year, the Girondin came after Marat, arresting him for advocating for violence against members of the convention, and used 19 pages of quotes from Marat's writings to prove it. Marat, of course, defended himself and claimed that he had merely been misquoted and misunderstood. Marat argued that he was doing what was best for the people. In 1792, he said that, "If I advised bringing down 500 heads, it was in order to save 500,000 innocent ones." He really thought that what was best for France was to end the revolution as quickly as possible, victoriously, of course, and the best way to do that was to kill its enemies before France's enemies killed them. Historian Susan Hoffman wrote, "Marat saw the revolution in moralistic terms, as a struggle between virtue and baseness, humanity and barbarism." History has taught me to always be wary of those who see the world only in black and white, the way that Marat did, for rarely is it ever really that simple. And rarely does this type of thinking lead to anything productive. Marat took the floor of the National Convention and gave a passionate speech in his defense. He argued that what the Girondin accused him of was, quote, "in violation of law and in contradiction to the principles of order, liberty, and justice, for it is a principle of right that no citizen shall be censured without having first been heard," end quote. Did he realize how hypocritical this is? What about all the people who were imprisoned because of him and without having a legitimate hearing? What about those who were killed without one? Right. It wasn't his fault that the people actually did what he told them to. He continued, quote, "What will appear incredible is that the committee should call down, without ceremony, without shame, without remorse, capital punishment on my head," end quote. Seriously? Live by the sword, die by the sword, bro. What, you thought that you, of all people, were immune to the revolution's violence? And then he said, quote, "It accuses me of having incited to murder and pillage. This act is a tissue of lies and fabrications," end quote. Fake news, everyone. Incredibly, the tribunal acquitted Marat. Or maybe not incredible, seeing how powerful the radical Montagnard had become at that point. The people erupted into cheers at their friend's acquittal, even tossing laurel wreaths onto Marat's greasy head. But unfortunately for the Girondin, this was a fatal misstep that sent their enemies on the offensive and sent the Girondin on the run. A little more than a month after Marat's acquittal, he and the Montagnard in the convention demanded the Girondin's expulsion. A commander of the National Guard, François Henriot, confronted the president of the convention after he spoke against going after the 22 Girondin deputies. Henriot threatened him, "Tell your fucking president that he and his convention can go fuck themselves. If within 1 hour the 22 are not delivered, we will blow them all up." Not everyone was ready to accept defeat, though. There were still plenty of people who believed in the revolution, who believed that it could be saved from the radical Jacobin, the Montagnard. One of them was the beautiful 24-year-old woman named Charlotte Corday. Charlotte Corday is a polarizing figure. She is either eulogized or villainized, depending upon the political views of those writing about her. Ernest Bax, the men's rights advocate, obviously despised her, but being a socialist himself, loved Marat and his friend of the people rhetoric. Of course, those moderate in their political views adored Corday. Madame Tussaud called her heroic. Others have called her the Joan of Arc of Liberty. It's difficult to find documents about her in which the author does not reveal their feelings about her. And of course, the older the documents are and the closer their lives were to the revolution, the more biased and emotional they become. Thus, Charlotte Corday became a symbol of the enemy of the revolution, of liberty, and living proof that all of radical conspiracy theories were correct, that they were right to be paranoid. Or Charlotte Corday was a symbol of resistance to Montagnard tyranny, proof that the revolution could still be saved. In reality, Charlotte Corday was all of these things, and yet also none of these things. She was neither angel nor harpy. Charlotte Corday was just a woman, and we do her no favors by trying to view her as superhuman. Marie-Anne Charlotte de Corday d'Armand was born to impoverished nobility in 1768. Her biographer, Bowen, noted that she was of pure Norman descent and could trace her family's titles of nobility all the way back to 1077. Legend held that her family had royal blood in their veins, descending from a king of Scotland. Corday was a granddaughter of the French tragedy writer Pierre Corneille. It will quickly become obvious to you that some of his dramatic flair must have filtered down to Corday, who surely knew of and studied his plays. Despite her illustrious lineage, the Cordays were one of the many noble families in France that suffered under the old regime. The feudal system was simply not working for them, for their land brought them little to no money, and being nobility in France meant that you should not work. Remember, if you can, back to your high school lessons on the feudal system, and how there were three classes. Those who work, which was the third estate, the working classes. Those who fight, the nobility, the landowners who defended the land and its people from their enemies, and those who pray, the clergy. So, in exchange for the nobility defending the people and the people do the work on their land, and the aristocracy saves their hands for fighting. Corday's mother died when she was young, and her father lived beyond his means and grew deeper into debt. He was unwilling to accept the reality of his situation and wanted to raise his children as nobility. Thus, he spent a bunch of money sending his sons to school. Corday was only 14 when her father could not afford to raise her anymore and sent her and her sister to live in an abbey founded by William the Conqueror in the 11th century in Caen, which is in northern France. Instead of feeling abandoned, Corday flourished there, soaking up the abbey's history and devouring its library. She was not drawn to novels and romances. She read everything she could about ancient Greece and Rome and fell in love with the tales of heroes defeating their country's tyrants. She loved reading about philosophy and politics and dove into every philosophical treatise she could get her hands on. But her absolute favorite author was Rousseau. Aside from some reports written by her enemies, including one that claimed Corday was, quote, without grace and dirty, as female philosophers and wits almost always are, end quote, All other sources were in near unanimous agreement that she was absolutely beautiful. Deep blue eyes, pearly teeth, a dimpled chin, and a clear, fair complexion that was so opposite of the many disfigured and scar-ridden faces people were used to. Her hair became a controversy, believe it or not. Those who saw her said it was an auburn color, but after her death, revolutionary artists portrayed it as blonde so as to make her seem more aristocratic, like the enemy. The historian Nina Gelbart even wrote an article about it titled "The Blonding of Charlotte Corday." Of her personality, those who cared for Corday described her as being difficult. She had a good heart, that was undisputed, but she found it hard to obey all of the convent's rules. She was restless. She felt as though she had missed the days of old when heroes walked the earth. She felt as though there was no place for her, no purpose. But then the revolution began, and she felt elated by it. She would be able to see Rousseau's ideas come to life, and the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen was incredible, just as Rousseau would have wanted it. She absorbed as much news as she could about the revolution's progress, and looked forward to the day she could say she lived in a republic. Then things turned violent. She surely would have heard what happened at the Bastille, of the March on Versailles. She wasn't afraid of bloodshed. She had read the stories of ancient Rome, and she knew that sometimes a little blood had to be spilled to do what was right. But she couldn't stand these radical Jacobins, these Montagnards who were chomping at the bit for heads, for more violence. More. More. And then the revolutionaries suppressed the churches, and Corday was forced to leave the abbey. By this time, her two brothers had fled France for their safety. One sister had died, and the other stayed with their father at his estate to take care of him. So Corday ended up at the decaying home of her aunt in the town of Caen. In May of 1792, National Guardsmen entered the nearby town of Versailles looking for priests. They entered a chapel where they began beating people, humiliating women by chopping off their hair, and took about 50 people prisoner, according to the historian Warren Roberts. They were not even priests, they were mostly women, but also children and the elderly. Roberts quotes Corday, saying, "You ask me what happened at Versailles, every imaginable abomination. It seems that it was largely women they had a grudge against. Three of them died a few days later. The rest are still ill." Her town of Caen thereafter became a center of counter-revolutionary activity, a Girondin hub. For Corday, it was no coincidence that this event occurred so soon after Marat returned to Paris, fresh out of hiding. And when the Tuileries were stormed, the royal family terrorized and their Swiss guards slaughtered, she was sure that Marat had something to do with it. No one can rile the people up so much and not be aware of the consequences of their actions. I could not find anything on how Corday felt about the murder and mutilation of Princess Lamballe, but I'm sure it was unsettling to her at the very least. Corday, too, was an aristocrat, same as so many of the others who were murdered in the September massacres. Same as Princess Lamballe, though of course not nearly as eminent. But Lamballe had committed no crime, and the mock tribunals the mob set up to try the prisoners made a mockery of their revolution. This was not liberty. This was no republic. This was tyranny. The tyranny of monsters like Marat. Then, in the beginning of 1793, they had the gall to guillotine the king. And, of course, Marat had to gloat, had to say, "All hearts give themselves over to the hope for a happier future." She was proud of the Girondin for trying to stop it. In April, the revolution became more personal to Corday. Father Gombeau, who had given her mother her last rites before she died in childbirth, was quite close to Corday. When radicals came after the clergy in northern France, Father Gombault went into hiding, supposedly in the forest near Cannes. But things didn't last long before Montagnard dragged him out of hiding and back to Cannes, where they guillotined him. She took all of these blows to her country personally. Thomas Dunphy compiled a history of Corday's trial and noted how she approached her aunt one day, telling her, quote, "I weep over the misfortunes of my country, over those of my relatives and yours. While Morat lives, no one can be sure of a day's existence." End quote. Not long after, she found Corday reading the Bible, which had been open to the story of Judith, the woman who decapitated a general in order to save her people. And Corday became angry, too. She left the house one day and saw people playing cards, and she snapped at them, saying, "You play and the country is dying." She didn't attend Girondin meetings, though she did keep her ears open to find out whatever news she could, and was known to discuss current events with guests, never being too afraid to speak her mind. Corday saw the Girondins flooding into Cannes after fleeing Paris in the wake of Marat's acquittal. She saw all of the volunteers preparing to take up arms, preparing to sacrifice their lives, if needed, for the good of their country. The Girondist leader Barbaroux posted a flyer in Cannes attacking Marat in June. And at some point, the idea solidified in her mind that she, too, should sacrifice for the good of her country. Better yet, she could save all of her countrymen by simply cutting the head off of the monster. She would kill Marat. In July, Corday visited her sister and father to say goodbye and told them she was going to England, where it was more safe from the violence that swallowed her country. When she returned to Cannes, she told her aunt the same and boarded a carriage headed not for England, but for Paris. She arrived there 2 days later, exhausted. The following day, she walked around the city trying to find out more information about Marat. During her travels, she contemplated the best way to kill him and decided on either killing him at the celebration planned for the anniversary of the Bastille's fall or while he was at the convention. In her own words, she wanted, quote, "to sacrifice him on the summit of the Montagne," even knowing that she too would likely be killed on the spot. But what she found out was that Marat would not be at either of those, because his skin condition had flared up and he was in too much pain to do much of anything other than sit in his medicated bath while he worked on his paper. She rose early the next day, July 13th, and made her way to the Palais Royal as the shops were opening for the day. She stopped at one and purchased an ebony-handled knife, and then wandered the gardens at the Tuileries, which had witnessed so much bloodshed but was now almost serene, with the king dead and the queen elsewhere. Sometime around 11 in the morning, she hailed a carriage to Marat's apartment on 30 Rue des Cordeliers. The women who opened the door told Corday it was impossible to see Marat because he was indisposed. She replied that it was urgent she speak to him as she had vital information about a counter-revolutionary conspiracy. The woman still refused, but said she could write him a letter, so Corday did. She returned to her hotel and wrote to Marat, saying basically the same thing she told the woman. While Corday waited for his response, she curled her hair and dressed nicely, thinking that perhaps if she could somehow get Marat to at least look at her, he would be intrigued enough to allow her in. At nearly 7 p.m., with still no response, Corday put on a black hat with a green ribbon, placed her birth certificate and a few letters into her striped dress, tucked the knife into it, and left the hotel. When she arrived at Marat's apartment, the doors were open. He was having bread delivered, and Laurent Basse, who delivered newspapers for Marat, had also arrived. Corday took the opportunity to slip inside and make her way to where she assumed the bedrooms were. Before she could get there, she was stopped by another woman, a common law wife of Marat named Simone Everard. Simone told Corday that she needed to leave, but Corday began making a fuss and talking loudly about how urgent it was that she see Marat and tell him a plot against him. Then a voice from behind the two women chimed in, saying, "Let her in." Corday entered the closet-sized room with a map of Paris hung on the wall next to an emblem of the Revolution. With the July heat, the window had been left open, as were all other windows in the neighborhood. She turned to the opposite side of the room and locked eyes with Jean-Paul Marat. Surely they would hate the comparison, but Marat and Corday had a lot more in common than people realize. Both were devoted to the Republic, both idolized Rousseau, both radical in their own ways. They both had a compulsive urge to correct injustices. It just so happened that they had two entirely different opinions of what an injustice was. These two people, so different and yet so alike, likely looked at each other with a bit of surprise. Marat reclined in the bathtub, though not the ones we are used to. His was shaped more like a boot and made of copper. An upturned wooden box that acted as a desk rested on top of the tub, with a green cloth thrown over it for decency. Marat must have been everything Corday expected him to be. His oily hair was wrapped in dirty, vinegar-soaked cloth. Sores embedded his inflamed skin, some seeping pus. He looked surprisingly ill, his sunken face making his eyes appear even larger than usual. He didn't just act like a monster. He was one. They only spoke for about 15 minutes. Marat asked Corday for the names of the Girondins who were plotting against him. She told him. He picked up his quill, dipped it in ink, and began scribbling the names down as she spoke. "Good," he said to her. "In a few days, I will have them all guillotined." It was the perfect prompt. He was probably still looking down at his desk when Corday slipped the knife out of her dress and plunged it just below his clavicle, all the way to the hilt, piercing an artery. Without really thinking, he shouted for Simone, "À moi, ma chère amie. Help me, my dear friend." Corday backed into the corner as Simone ran into the room, seeing Marat, knife in his chest, his head thrown back and lolling to the side. His right arm dangled outside the tub. "My God, he has been assassinated," she yelled. "What have you done?" Laurent Basse ran into the room and attempted to throw a chair at Corday, but missed, likely because the tiny room made throwing things a bit awkward. So instead, he threw himself on her, pinning her to the ground by her breasts. It was unnecessary. Corday would not have fled anyway. She went there to die. The open windows carried their voices through the neighborhood, bringing first a dentist who tried to render aid, followed by a surgeon who also could not stop the bleeding. The two carried Marat to his bed, leaving a trail of blood in their wake. National Guardsmen arrived and arrested Corday, binding her hands so tightly that it bruised her. So many people were pouring into the building and gathering in front of the street that they decided to keep her there until the crowds dispersed. In all the commotion, Corday's fichu, the triangular-shaped cloth that women wrapped around their chest for modesty, had slipped, and so Corday kept herself bent forward to hide her chest. She eventually asked the guards if they would unbind her hands so that she could fix her clothes. They removed the ropes, and Corday turned towards the wall while she fixed herself. Someone called for Madame Tussaud, who arrived so soon after the murder that Marat's face was still warm when she made his death mask. Or, in her words, a cast of the demon's features. The police arrived and began questioning Corday. She responded calmly, respectfully. She never tried to flee, she never cried nor showed fear or stress. Corday was so opposite of how Madame Tussaud remembered Marat while in hiding, always on edge and running away at every little sound. During the night, the police transferred her to the Abbey prison where, Shama says, she slept on a bed of straw and had the company of a black cat. She began writing letters, some an explanation of why she did what she did. One was a letter to her father begging his forgiveness. She wrote, "Forgive me, my dear Papa, for having disposed of my existence without your permission. I have avenged many innocent victims. I have prevented many other disasters. I beg you to forget me, or rather rejoice at my fate. The cause is good." By the time Corday was brought to trial, she had already been questioned at Marat's apartment and again in her cell. When asked why she did what she did, she replied, "I have killed one man to save 100,000. Her interrogators could not believe that she, as just one woman, could have plotted such an act on her own and kept demanding to know who helped her. She said, "I was a Republican well before the revolution, and I have never lacked energy." The interrogator asked what she meant by energy. Corday replied, "Those who put their own interests to one side and know how to sacrifice themselves for the country." Marat's wound was so perfectly placed, avoiding any bones that might deflect the blow, that they had to ask her if she had been practicing before the murder. "Oh," she said, offended, "the monster takes me for a murderer." Well, she was, but what she meant was that she was no practiced killer. Her perfect blow was luck. The interrogator could still not believe she acted alone and again asked who she worked with. "I would never have committed such an act on the advice of others. I alone conceived the plan and executed it." "But how could they believe it was only her idea," the man asked, "when all Marat did was for the good of the people? All he ever did was unmask traitors and conspirators." "It's only in Paris that people have eyes for Marat," she said. "In other departments, he is regarded as a monster." He responded, asking how she could possibly call him a monster when the only reason why she even got so close to Marat to begin with was because of an act of humanity on his part, because she told him that she was being persecuted. "What difference does it make that he showed himself human towards me if he was a monster toward others?" she asked. The interrogator replied, "Do you think you have killed all the Marats?" She responded, "With this one dead, the others will fear, perhaps." Not that there was any doubt that Corday would be found guilty, but the tribunal unanimously declared it so and sentenced her to the guillotine. Guards returned her to her cell, where she received another visit from Madame Tussaud, who remembered her complete lack of fear. One of Corday's requests to the tribunal was that she have her portrait painted by one of the guards who had sketched her earlier. Her request accepted, the man returned to her cell and began painting. The artist wasn't finished when the door opened and the executioner walked in. Corday was surprised and said, "What, already?" She cut off a lock of her hair and gave it to the artist, then took a seat and told the executioner to cut her hair, as is custom before being guillotined. The executioner then draped the red shirt reserved for assassins being sent to their death. Having had so few female assassins, the shirt was too large and hung off of her. She then mounted the cart that transported her to the guillotine. Just as the cart departed, the skies unleashed a downpour of rain that drenched Corday, plastering her newly cut hair to her face and the red cloth to her body. The crowds gathered in awe at this angel of assassin, of how dignified she appeared on her way to death. She stood tall with her head up all the way to the scaffold. She only showed emotion once by sighing because the massive crowds had prevented the cart from moving faster. The executioner turned to her and said, "You find the way very long, I fear?" "No matter," she said. "We are sure to reach the scaffold sooner or later." When they arrived, the executioner stood in front of Corday, hoping to block her view of the guillotine to spare her any distress, but Corday peered around him anyway, smiling and saying, "I have a right to be curious. This is the first time I see it." The executioner was in the process of preparing for the execution by clearing the audience out of the way, and thus was not ready when Corday marched up and laid down on the guillotine of her own accord. The executioner didn't want to extend her suffering any longer than necessary, so, despite not being ready, he signaled for the blade to drop. The carpenter, who supposedly helped erect the scaffold, picked up Corday's head and showed it to the crowd, much to the executioner's disgust. Then, before anyone could say anything, the carpenter slapped Corday's cheek twice. People gasped in horror as the head's cheeks flushed and supposedly gave a look of indignation. This caused quite a scandal among Parisians, who had already held passionate debates about whether or not a head still maintained consciousness for a few short moments after beheading. Some people said Corday was proof of this, especially since both cheeks flushed rather than just the one side the carpenter slapped. A surgeon said that no, the cheeks only appeared to flush because the carpenter held his hand in such a way that it prevented the blood from pouring out of the neck, and so instead that blood accumulated in her cheeks. The execution backfired slightly because all anyone could talk about was how dignified and heroic Corday was upon her death, and how beautiful she was. Parisians had seen many beheadings at this point and marveled at how much more courage this one woman showed than so many others. Not once did she tremble, cry, or beg. Madame Tussaud saw Corday once more as she took her death mask. Authorities then took her body to get an autopsy. Apparently, they still could not believe that she acted alone and swore that she must have been under the spell of some lover who convinced her to do it, so they wanted to know whether or not she was a virgin. Supposedly, the autopsy showed that she was, in fact, a virgin. They buried Corday's body in pit number 5 at a local cemetery, right next to the former king. Her head, though, was another story. According to some of Corday's biographers, and what might have just been hearsay, Danton took possession of her head after her execution, and then gave it to his friend and fellow radical Jacobin, Saint-Alban, who supposedly kept it preserved in a jar that he once showed at a dinner party. The historian, Duroy, visited the home of Saint-Alban and saw the head in the back of his cupboard and asked him why the hell he had a head in his cupboard. Saint-Alban replied that, "If I were to put it in full view on a sideboard, my visitors might pull a long face. And besides, it would not be a very pleasant sight for my children." "No, I would think not." Duroy then supposedly took possession of the head, who then gave it to Prince Roland Bonaparte. The supposed, now just skull, of Charlotte Corday was last seen by the public in a museum exhibition in 1966, which was lent by the granddaughter of Prince Bonaparte. Everyone assumes that the skull is still in the Bonaparte family's collection. Jacques-Louis David idolized Marat even before his assassination martyred him. Instead of being repulsed by Marat's diseased body, David likely felt a kinship with him because of it. What disfigurement felt like, too. Chama tells that when David was younger, a sword fight left him with a wound to his cheek that evolved into a tumor. The tumor grew larger as he aged, to the point where his enemies called him David with the swollen cheek. Not only was he self-conscious of his appearance and hid his tumor in shadows when painting portraits of himself, the tumor was quite uncomfortable. Because it made him sound so awkward when he spoke, David rarely spoke at all. I suppose it's a good thing, then, that he chose to be an artist rather than an orator. He was the artist of the French Revolution, and his colleagues called on him whenever they needed sketches of important people or an elaborate funeral to plan, as they did upon Marat's death. The Cordelier and Jacobin clubs fought over Marat's heart, which ultimately ended up in an urn that hung suspended from the Cordelier club's ceiling. David was left with Marat's body, only half embalmed and all decaying, that he staged in his coffin just as his wife found him in the bathtub. He was having a hell of a time with the corpse, whose eyes wouldn't completely close, and bloated tongue kept sticking out. Even in death, Marat couldn't keep his mouth shut, so David finally had to cut his tongue out in order to close it. David must have figured that if he couldn't beat death, he might as well have used it to his advantage and show the people of France just what the enemy had done to their beloved friend. David built a large triangular-shaped platform built to display Marat's coffin, with Marat at the peak, and a set of stairs on either side for people to walk up and pay their respects. He dropped Marat's bloody shirt over the corpse for further effect. Apparently, a mourner ran up to Marat to hold his hand, causing his arm to fall off. It seems as though David used someone else's arm as a prop since Marat's was too deteriorated. The London Times reported on the funeral procession, noting the mournful music and cannon blasts meant to honor Marat. Eventually, they buried him beneath a tree in the Cordelier garden, which was marked by a plain tombstone. Later, in 1794, they moved Marat to the Pantheon, where Rousseau and Voltaire were also interred. Chama noted how, quote, "Marat dead was perhaps more useful to the Jacobins than the unpredictable, choleric, live politician." End quote. And they used his death and the people's outrage of it to their advantage. One Jacobin spoke to the people, saying, "My friends, let us avenge the death of one of our friends. Let the guillotine be permanent, and let those who did us so much harm be punished." After his death, the great friend of the people evolved into some sort of demigod cult-like figure. They named streets after him, as well as parks, songs, restaurants. The engraving for his tomb in the Pantheon read, "Their Jesus was but a false prophet, but Marat is a god. Long live the heart of Marat. Like Jesus, Marat loved the people ardently. Like Jesus, Marat detested nobles, priests, the rich, the scoundrels." Perhaps the greatest of their propaganda was David's painting, The Death of Marat. Continuing in this creepy Jesusization trend, David painted Marat as though he were Jesus, dead on the cross, the ultimate martyr. The painting was part true to life, with Marat in his tub and quill in hand, but he omitted nearly all traces of his skin condition, the tub and the wrap around his head the only reminders of why Marat was there instead of in the convention. The background is the black of death, and the whites only serve to highlight the sacred blood he had shed, and a letter from the traitor Corday. The painting is easily one of the most famous works of art ever completed. Like many of the best paintings, it stops viewers in their tracks. It forces them to look, to see the horror of what had been done to their poor friend Marat. I have to agree with Chama when he said, "I'm not sure how I feel about this painting, except deeply conflicted." It is, as Chama says, at once beautiful and repulsive. But times change, revolutions end, and those who were once martyrs are reverted back to monsters. Changing political tides had Marat's corpse removed from the Pantheon, and David's painting was hidden for 3 decades, with David himself having to flee France. It is now that I have to remind you that the Terror, the era of the revolution known as the bloodiest, did not begin until after the September massacres, after Princess Lamballe's murder, after the king's execution, after Corday's murder of Marat and Corday's subsequent beheading. Because instead of Corday's actions ending the bloodshed and saving the revolution, it had the opposite effect. Between Marat's death and the summer of 1794, about 50,000 people were killed for supposed crimes against liberty. Only 1/3 of these were carried out by guillotine. And this does not even count the nearly 200,000 killed in a counter-revolutionary uprising in the Vendée in western France. And after the Terror ended with Robespierre's execution, the year 1795 saw the beginning of the White Terror, when the revolution turned on Jacobins, the ones who orchestrated the Great Terror. Thus, the revolution eats its own. At least, said one Girondin orator about Charlotte Corday, she has killed us, but she has taught us how to die. I hope you enjoy these episodes about the French Revolution. I have to say I had tons of fun researching and writing them. If you did enjoy it, please leave us a rating or review on whatever platform you use to listen. It goes a long way to helping the podcast be found by others, and more listeners makes it easier for us to put out the episodes you love. For information on the episode and a list of sources, please see the show notes or visit oldbloodpodcast.com. We are also on Facebook and regularly post images and info to our Instagram, which you can find by searching for Old Blood Podcast. Music credits to Shane Ivers at SilvermanSound.com.